This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tonight on PBS, the American Masters series presents a 90-minute biography called Mel Brooks, Make a Noise. And that's provided the occasion for a conversation between Mel Brooks and our TV critic, David Bianculli. David has loved the comedy of Mel Brooks since the 60s, when David became a fan of Brooks' spy spoof series, Get Smart. Now David teaches TV history at Rowan University, and he shows his students some of Brooks's very early work, from back in the 50s, when Brooks was a writer on the groundbreaking NBC variety show, Your Show of Shows, which starred Sid Caesar. Brooks wrote and directed the films Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, High Anxiety, and The Producers. He later adapted The Producers into a Broadway musical, which broke the record for the most Tony wins. David spoke with Mel Brooks about the American Masters salute and a lot more. Their conversation began with a clip from filmmaker Richard Trachtenberg's portrait, Make a Noise. The first story Brooks tells in the documentary is about his formative introduction to the Broadway musical.
Okay, I'm 9 years old. Uncle Joe drove a taxi cab. One day he said, "Hey, Mel, I got two tickets to a brand new show called Anything Goes." And he said, "Well, it's a musical, it's on Broadway, and we've got two seats, the last two seats in the last row of the second balcony." It's thrilling, in Broadway theater, I'm 9 years old.
"Why, it's Gabriel, Gabriel, Cyan, Gabriel, Gabriel, Cyan."
I couldn't catch my breath. There was Ethel Merman, no microphones. And she was still too loud, you know, and it was about 2 miles away. One incredible number after another. I was literally crying with happiness.
Mel Brooks, welcome to Fresh Air.
David Bianculli, a pleasure to be here.
What I love about that is that you have so much enthusiasm in your voice. And I've always thought that you couldn't really do a great parody of something unless you understood and enjoyed it.
True, very true. I mean, unless you... I loved Westerns as a little kid, and I loved horror films. And I had fun with them, but I also saluted the glory of the Western and the glory of James Whale's, you know, Frankenstein and Dracula. And we you know, what does a little kid in Brooklyn have when it comes to art? It ain't much, but it's those movies that you got in. And we didn't have any money. I was the baby boy of four. Altogether, with four brothers. My mother lost her husband. I lost my father. I was only two, and he died of tuberculosis. And we were really, poor. I mean, dead poor. And I remember my mother gave me three bottles. I wanted desperately to see a Ken Maynard Western. I mean, desperately. And you get two other pictures with it. You get three pictures for a dime. She gave me 9 cents. I mean, she gave me three bottles, which 3 cents on each deposit bottle at Mr. Shanus's grocery store. I had 9 cents. I needed another penny. And I said, "Mom, I need another penny to get into the movies." I must have been about, you know, 7 or 8, I don't know. And she said, "I don't have it." So she knocked on Mrs. Miller's door. She said, "Mrs. Miller, we don't have any cash in the house. Can I have a penny?" So I cherish those movies because they really lifted my spirits and are indelibly engraved in my brain as important steps in my world education.
And what about, say, Alfred Hitchcock, whom you lampooned in High Anxiety? Those would have come a little later for you, but
much
you clearly
later,
loved those too.
I always thought, you know, that Alfred Hitchcock was the very best director who ever directed films. And when I was doing, I had the idea for High Anxiety. I wrote him a letter saying basically, "Dear Mr. Hitchcock, I do genre parodies, and in my estimation, you are a genre. I don't mean that you're overweight. I mean that you've done every style and every type of movie, and that you're just amazing. And I would like to do a movie dedicated to you and based on your style and your work." And he said, he called me and he said, "I loved, I love Blazing Saddles. I think you're a very talented guy. And I come to my office. I came to his office at Universal. And he told me to come back every Friday at a quarter to 12, because at 12:30 we would eat. So 45 minutes of work. And he would work on my script on High Anxiety with me. And he said, well, don't leave out this and don't leave out that. He said, what are you going to do about the birds? I said, well, gee, at the moment I haven't included it. And he said, well, why don't you have them attack you with their duty? He said, it's going to be funny. I said, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hitchcock. And so he gave me the birds, and he gave me a couple of others. He gave me one joke I couldn't use. He's a very, very interesting writer.
What was the joke you couldn't use?
I couldn't use it because, I mean, it wasn't part of his work. So, but he said, there's a guy running. We don't know who he is, a good guy, a bad guy. And there are other men chasing him. And they start shooting at him. And he reaches a pier. And about 8 or 10 feet away, there's a ferry. And he makes a gigantic leap, a great arc. And he actually lands on the lip, on the deck of the ferry. He makes it.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the ferry is coming in, not leaving, so they keep shooting him. But I said, gee, that's a great joke, but I couldn't use it. I loved him. He was colorful, he was sweet, and he saw the rough cut of High Anxiety. And he got up and wiggled by me, never said a word. I said, oh, my God, it's, I'm ruined. It's terrible. And he left, and 24 hours later, a beautiful wooden box arrives, placed on my desk. It is 6 magnums of Chateau Aubriand, 1961. Priceless. Maybe the greatest wine ever made, including Rothschild or any other. And with a little note saying, have no anxiety over High Anxiety. It's wonderful. Love, Hitch.
The producers, I consider your masterwork, and you've reworked it several very clever times. I want to start with the 1968 movie and play a fast clip and then ask you some questions about it. It's basically about an accountant who discovers that a producer could make a fortune with a flop Broadway show by raising millions for a program that's so bad it would actually close on opening night. In the movie, in the original 1968 film, Zero Mostel plays the producer, Gene Wilder plays the accountant, and in this scene they're going through stacks of scripts looking for a really bad play, which the producer thinks he's just found.
Touch it, touch it.
What is it?
Smell it. See it? Touch it, touch it.
What is it?
What is it? We've struck gold. Not fool's gold, but real gold. The mother lode. The mother lode. The mother of them all. Kiss it, kiss it.
You found a flop.
A flop? That's putting it mildly. We found a disaster, a catastrophe, an outrage, a guaranteed to close in one night beauty.
Let's see it.
Let's see. This is freedom for one forever. This is a house in the country. This is a Rolls Royce and a Bentley. This is wine, women, and song, and women.
Springtime for Hitler. A gay romp with Adolf and Eva at Berchtesgaden. Wow.
Wow. It's practically a love letter to Hitler.
This won't run a week.
A week? Are you kidding? This play has got to close on page 4.
That was Zero Mostel and Gene Wilder in the original movie version of The Producers. When you won the Oscar for, I guess, Best Original Screenplay for The Producers, you thanked Gene Wilder 3 times. Why did you do that?
Well, because Gene, like Sid Caesar in my life, I've had a couple of guys. Well, Zero was magnificent, really.
Mm-hmm.
But Gene brought a certain something that was never before. It was kind of creative comedy. And he worked tirelessly. He's really the nucleus, the brilliant key to the emotion of the whole piece. And Gene worked almost for scale, for nothing. Day and night. And he was so... I couldn't thank him enough. When I finally put the movie together, I said, it would have been a good movie with just Zero Mostel and anybody, but with Gene Wilder, it's a wondrous movie.
Well, he's so important to your legacy, and the casting in a lot of your projects is so critical. So to jump to the Broadway version of The Producers, how did you decide, or how quickly did you decide on Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick?
Well, we already had Nathan right from the beginning. As soon as we thought of Max Bialystock, we thought of Nathan Lane, you know. And Nathan also thought Matthew was a great choice. And Matthew is very, very good talent. He's a good singer. He can do anything.
Well, here's an example of their chemistry. This is from the 2005 movie version of The Producers with Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick. Just a fast clip when they're discussing the upcoming show. And Matthew Broderick's Leo Bloom asks how much money they should be investing in their own show.
Bloom, the two cardinal rules of being a Broadway producer are, one, never put your own money in the show.
And two,
never put your own money in the show!
Get it?
Got it.
Good.
No matter how many times I hear that, it's laugh out loud funny to me.
And it's true. I believe it. I've never put my own money in the show, you know. I put my talent on the line. And my money I save for Saturday night restaurants.
Now, you watched them perform so many times and then did the movie. How did their onstage chemistry change or deepen over time from your perspective?
Good word, good word, good word, David Bianculli, good word. It deepened. It did deepen because they got to love each other more and more in terms of their characters feeling the emotion for each other. So when finally, you know, near the end of their first year together, when we were in tears when Bloom makes that speech in the courtroom about how good Bialystock really is and how much he loves him. And so it did deepen.
I'm very curious. Have you seen Spamalot or Book of Mormon? And do you think that The Producers made those possible?
I do. I loved both of those shows, and they're both very, very good, very wonderful, and very funny, and both of them never caved into excessive emotion. They went with a naked sword slashing away from comedy, both of them, and they're both incredible, terrific shows, and I think they may owe a little to my breakthrough, you know. The musical comedy, except for maybe On the Way to the Forum, was gone. And I brought back the, you know, Bells Are Ringing and Where's Charlie? And I brought back the musical comedy. And I think, in a way, responsible for Spamalot and probably freeing people up to do Mormon.
We're listening to the interview Mel Brooks recorded with our TV critic David Bianculli. Tonight, the PBS series American Masters presents a portrait of Brooks. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview Mel Brooks recorded with our TV critic David Bianculli. Tonight on PBS, American Masters presents a documentary about Brooks. Among Brooks's many awards is a Kennedy Center honor, which he was presented in 2009.
What was it like to get a Kennedy Center honors from Barack Obama? And one of the things that you were getting it for was Blazing Saddles with all the content in there.
Yeah, well, he, in his speech, first of all, he said, he kind of yelled at me. He said, Mel, stop talking. I'd like to say something nice about you, you know. And he said, I was only 12 years old, I snuck in and I saw Blazing Saddles. And he said, it changed my life. It was a wonderful little speech. And he said, but I think the statute of limitations has run out. They can't get me for sneaking in, you know. But he was very, I mean, he said some wonderful, lovely, lovely things. I shouldn't say this because it's so...
Well, you should.
I don't know.
Go,
but
say it.
I'll say it anyway. I was offered this... The Kennedy Center honors, maybe a year or two before. And I said, well, I'm going to wait for another president if I'm still alive, you don't mind, you know. And I just didn't feel comfortable when Bush was president to accept the honors.
I don't know. I don't know that anybody's ever done that before.
I did it because I, you know, I... because I don't need, you know, had I not had, got 110 awards, I maybe, you know, I'm an EGOT, so I don't need any more.
That's let's see, Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's okay. That's enough. And the Kennedy Center honors, I really, at the moment, I didn't need them. And I turned out, I don't want to, you know, but there's a lot of awards. The only award I haven't received, I think, is Woman of the Year. and that, you know, I don't know if that's not in the works just as an honorary Woman of the Year, you know. I may get that, too. But I'm not looking for it. Listen, David, I'm a has-been, and I know it, and you know it. And it's very kind of you to let me be on the radio. Look, David, I was Academy Award. I was there. I'm down to NPR. I'm down to radio. I'm in shreds. Look at me. Well, you know, look, I'm not even, it's public radio. I mean, nobody's even paying for this. And look, this is my career. I'm finished. It's over. I'm picking up cigarette butts.
And yet,
the studio here.
And yet, I have it from a fairly reliable source that you're tinkering around with making a Broadway musical version of Blazing Saddles.
Well, it's annoying me. It is. It's really bothering me. It's really, I tell my mind, there are other things. Let's pursue trying to get off Rolaids and being, you know, getting our stomach, you know, acid free. But Blazing Saddles keeps annoying me. So, I mean, I think the public would like it. And I think that if I got investors to put money into this Blazing Saddles musical, that it would work everywhere except Broadway. So maybe I take it out for a year. If I live, I don't know. You know, I'll be 90 next week. You know, but if I and then bring it to Broadway without the investors, you know, I always respect the people who put money in things without them failing. You know, so at least they got their money back, and then we could take a chance.
Well, there are so many good songs already in Blazing Saddles, and I figure this is a good excuse to play part of one. It's Madeline Kahn.
Bless you. Bless you, B.N. Cooley.
Well, she's the one who did it, a frontier version of Marlena Dietrich singing I'm Tired. It's it's a great song written by you. It's a fantastic performance and so comic. And let's just listen to a little of it.
Stage door Johnny's constantly surround me. They always hound me with one request. Who can satisfy their lustful habits? I'm not a rabbit. I need some rest. I'm tired, sick and tired of love. I've had my fill of love from below and above.
All right, what are you thinking right now?
The tears thinking about Madeline and what an incredibly gifted, a gift from God, Madeline Kahn. I mean, the funniest and most talented comedian, I think, including people like Carol Burnett, who are great, you know, and Gilda Radner, who was magnificent, but nobody, listen to me, David Bianculli, nobody could approach the magnificence and the wonder of Madeline Kahn. She was really a great gift to us all.
Well, she's quoted in your new American Masters biography as saying that you saw things in her that no one else saw. What did you see?
Well, actually, I saw art, not just funny, but I saw a person who was gifted with art. You know, she's the only one who could actually have worked in opera, as an opera singer, as a coloratura. She was that talented. Or I think she could work as a longshoreman in New Jersey. I don't think there's anything that Madeline Kahn couldn't do.
Now, you seem to have a great track record directing and writing for women. I mean, not only Madeline Kahn, Cloris Leachman, Terry Garr, getting really wonderful comic performances from these women. What was your method?
Well, you know, it was respecting their ability to deliver comedy, as well as, and sometimes a lot better than male comedians. And they knew that I respected their ability and their talent. And they gave all because of it. And they weren't ashamed or afraid to reveal maybe unconscious aspects of their comedy talent, which may have been a little off color, a little crazy, or a little bizarre that they wouldn't show anybody, but they'd show it to me because they knew I respected the full range of their gifts.
Mel Brooks will continue his interview with our TV critic David Bianculli in the second half of the show. Tonight, the PBS series American Masters presents a documentary about Brooks. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to the interview our TV critic David Bianculli recorded with Mel Brooks. Tonight, the PBS series American Masters presents a documentary about Brooks called Make a Noise. When we left off, Brooks was talking about his 1974 movie, Blazing Saddles.
Young Frankenstein came out the same year as Blazing Saddles. The standout scene has Gene Wilder as the scientist and Peter Boyle as the creature singing Puttin' on the Ritz. And I know that that was not your idea. That was co-writer Gene Wilder's.
Yes.
So how long did it take before you figured out he was right? And then I have a question about what sort of direction you gave to Peter Boyle for that number, especially his singing.
Well, actually, you know, when Gene first brought it up to show the wizardry of this, Dr. Frankenstein coming up with this incredible creature, reanimating dead tissue. And not only does it move, does it walk and talk, but it also dazzles you with song and dance, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I think we're tearing it, Gene. I think, we're going too far. We want some of the verisimilitudinous quality that was in the in the original James Whale movie, you know, which was serious and scary, and I don't want to lose the seriousness and the scariness of it just for silly comedy, you know, just for taking comedy too far. And he kept pushing. He said, no, it will demonstrate the doctor's abilities to teach the monster. And finally, he kept bugging me, and I said, look, okay, I'm going to shoot it, and I'm going to put it aside, and we'll see whether or not it's useful in the main body of the picture, okay? He said, okay, that's all I ask. Just shoot it and look at it later when you're putting it together. And I shot it, and I still was afraid of it. And then when I saw it later with all the film that we had collected, I said, gee, it may be the best thing in the film. And I called Gene, and I said, you're absolutely right all the time, and I'm glad it's in. Totally, and I'm looking on the cutting room floor for any outtakes, you know.
And what direction did you give to Peter Boyle? Like how he and was Puttin' on the Ritz always the first song choice?
Yes, always. Irving Berlin, and I said, Peter, sing it from your heart, sing it like it's a cry of love and freedom and everything you can think of that's good, and he did.
We have the real thing to listen to here. Let's go to Peter Boyle as the creature, introduced by Gene Wilder as, I guess at this point he's still Frankenstein.
I think he is still Frankenstein.
Okay, in young.
No, wait a minute. I don't know. It's maybe when he's sitting on his lap, he says, "Call me Frankenstein." I don't know.
But
you
here we are. Here we go. Yeah. Yes, you do have to see this movie. Here it is from 1974.
Ladies and gentlemen, mesdames et messieurs, damen und herren, from what was once an inarticulate mass of lifeless tissues, may I now present a cultured, sophisticated man about town. Hit it! If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes, or cutaway coat, perfect fits. Dressed up like a $1 million trooper, trying mighty hard to look like Gary Cooper.
Come, let's mix where Rock. You know, I have to thank you. I have to thank you for that scene. It may be one of my favorite scenes in all of cinema comedy.
Alan Johnson is the choreographer who did Springtime for Hitler, the big number, and he also did, you know, Putting on the Ritz. Alan Johnson, a great, great choreographer. And the two guys, you know, two wings that helped me fly through movies are Alan Johnson for choreography and John Morris for musical score.
Mm-hmm.
And those without those two guys, none of my movies would have reached the heights it did.
Well, what I want to talk about now is your TV work. Starting at the very beginning, Admiral Broadway Review and your show of shows, your first TV jobs. Your show of shows?
I've done too much. Listen, David, I've done too much for your broadcast. You know, unless you want to spend a day.
I'll do faster questions.
NPR,
I'll do faster questions.
NPR.
You do shorter answers.
I've done too much.
Your show of shows, the writing rooms for Sid Caesar, for your show of shows and the stuff he did afterwards, I still think is the all-time best collection of writing talent ever. And I wanted to know if you thought that and what it was like being in there. Was it imposing? Was it inspirational?
On looking back, I agree. But at the time, we were just a couple of pups in a cardboard box. You know, we were just fighting to get to our mom, fighting to get to King Caesar, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Me, my joke, my idea, my sketch, you know. But there was a lot of support and a lot of talent.
Well, name some of the
pups.
Mel
Tolkien.
Yes.
Well, Mel Tolkien was the head writer. And, you know, a very deeply intellectual, artistic guy who put me on to people like Andreev and Nikolai Gogol. I mean, I'd never read these guys. And, you know, and once I read Dead Souls by Nikolai Gogol, I knew there was great comic art in the world that I didn't know anything about. And he also knew about it because I was throwing up between parked cars, waiting to get fired any day because I was just a kid from Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and I should have been heading for the Garment Center. I should have been a shipping clerk. And here I was writing the Admiral Broadway Review for Sid Caesar, and so Tolkien got me a psychoanalyst. And I didn't even know the word, and I never heard of Freud, but... But it worked and did help me get through some very rough emotional, you know, psychic times.
We're listening to the interview Mel Brooks recorded with our TV critic, David Bianculli. Tonight, the PBS series American Masters presents a portrait of Brooks. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview Mel Brooks recorded with our TV critic, David Bianculli. Tonight on PBS, American Masters presents a documentary about Brooks.
I'm going to jump to the 2,000-year-old man now. You started this act at parties. You recorded an album. You won a Grammy. You went on from there. I figured before I ask you my questions about the 2,000-year-old man, I'd give a taste. This is from you and Carl on The Andy Williams Show from 1966.
Oh, good. I don't remember that. Let me hear it.
Okay.
Of all the discoveries of all time, what would you consider the greatest? Would you say it was the wheel, the lever, fire?
Fire, fire. Far and away, fire. Fire was the hottest thing going. Fire, yeah. You can't beat fire.
Really?
Fire
really?
Used to warm us and light up our caves so we wouldn't walk into a wall, so we wouldn't marry our brother Bernie.
That's
fire. And cooking, oh, fire, you can't beat fire.
When did they first learn to cook with fire?
It was an accident. That was an accident.
It was.
Chicken. Chicken walked into the fire by mistake and over. Burnt up.
Well, pet chicken?
Yes, we did. We didn't use them.
Didn't.
We kept them around the cave as pets. We loved to hear, we loved that.
Oh, they laid it.
So we took it out to give it a funeral, you know, and bury it because it was a pet. And we all went, Hey, that smells good. So we ate them up, and since then we've been eating chickens.
You know, I've heard this story, but I've heard that the animal that wandered into the fire accidentally was a pig.
Not in my cave.
That's Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner in one of their 2,000-year-old man sketches. Do you remember how much of that, if any, was improvised?
Well, actually, when we were on television, we laid out the jokes. We laid out what we would do. When we made our first two albums, I said to Carl, don't tell me anything. Nothing in advance. Just hit me with questions, and when I can't come up with a good answer, cut it. When I come up with a great answer, keep it in. And that's the way we did our first two albums, you know, various characters. And, of course, the 2,000-year-old man emerged as the leading comedy force in the albums.
Carl Reiner is widely and rightly acknowledged as one of the great straight men of all time. And working opposite him must have been a joy. But your friendship with him goes far past the projects you've done together. And now you're getting together almost every night to watch movies and have dinner. It sounds like such a nice thing to do.
Yeah, well, it is. He's my best friend. And, you know, we're like Bialystok and Bloom. We're joined at the hip. And he lost his wife maybe 2 years ago. I lost my wife maybe 10 years ago. So it's actually 8, to be exact. And we miss them, and they loved each other too. So we can't find any other people that understand our ancient references, you know. and so, you know, we're very comfortable with each other, because we never have to worry about images, what we say or what we do. And he's still, you know, he's still, Carl is still a pretty damn funny guy.
Mm-hmm.
and can do really, I mean, the other night we had an American Masters.
And Carl is, is Carl 90 now?
No, he's not 90, no. He's 91.
Sorry to have insulted him. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, don't insult him. Yeah. He's 91, and he's really doing what a lot of guys, you know, half his age, you know, could not even think of doing.
Now, when you guys are watching movies together, just for your own enjoyment, and you're watching comedies, who and what, you know, gets you to laugh the most now?
Oh, well, that's a tough question, because if you say one name, you're going to hurt somebody else's feelings. But, you know,
being exclusionary, what's the last one that you both watched together that made you both laugh? I'm not saying be inclusive, but what's the most recent one?
Well, I think Wreck-It Ralph, we saw the cartoon. We liked it.
Mm-hmm.
With John C. Reilly playing Ralph. I don't know if you know the cartoon.
Yeah, no, I know that.
And we just loved, you know, Penelope, played by Sarah Silverman. She's glorious.
Yes.
And generally, she's one of the few new, you know, there's Amy Schumer has come along, too, who's wonderful. But, I mean, but there are people that come along that are really good and funny, you know, and Silverman was, we both love her.
I want to play one last clip. This is one that I absolutely adore. It's not a film you directed. It's a remake of To Be or Not to Be, in which you and your wife, Anne Bancroft, play actors in Poland on the eve of World War II. And there's an early scene where you two perform a singing and dancing duet in Polish of Sweet Georgia yeah. Brown. To me, it looks like pure joy. And
It was pure joy. It was pure joy.
So can you tell me about how was that song chosen? How much rehearsal did it take to do it? And what do you remember
about
filling
it? Well, Sweet Georgia Brown is one of Anne's favorite songs and one of mine. And, you know, and we'd often sing it together anyway. And because I could do the harmonies and stuff. And when To Be or Not to Be, we said, well, let's do that. But we're in Poland. I suggested we do it in Polish, you know, and just the only English we would do would be Sweet Georgie Brown, you know. And it was, it worked. It was, all I can tell you is that, unfortunately, the filmmaker and me failed because we opened with it. You can only go downhill.
Mm-hmm.
You can only go downhill from Sweet Georgia Brown and Polish. You can't, you know, there's no way of topping it.
How much rehearsal did it take?
Oh, about a month, you know, because we had a Polish teacher who taught Eastern languages. When I say Eastern, I mean Russian and mm-hmm. Polish at UCLA. And she'd spend an hour with us every day working on the song and working on the lyrics that are Polish. Because, I don't know, she and somebody else did a translation of it.
Well,
and then we had to learn it. We mm-hmm. had to learn, you know, how to sing it in Polish.
Well, on the radio, you can't get the choreography, and you can't get that you guys are dressed elegantly and singing enthusiastically, but you can certainly hear the joy from this. Here's a taste from To Be or Not To Be with Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft singing Sweet Georgia Brown in another language.
Jak się topi, to się topi, Sweet Georgia Brown. Daj całusa, poleć wusa, Sweet Georgia Brown. Ja przez ciebie będę w niebie, Sweet Georgia Brown. Los to się znasz, ten co pewnie masz. Okej. Okay. Mój kolega mnie ostrzega, ratuje pan. Ona z każdym panem ważnym, ten co ma plan. Będzie biło serce twoje, bliżej bracie zdrowie swoje. Georgie Bia, Georgie Gia, Sweetie Pretty Georgie Brown. Marsh, 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 crunch,
I get such joy listening to these clips that I forget the questions that I want to ask you on the other way out of this. That was Anne Bancroft and Mel Brooks singing in To Be or Not To Be from 1983. Does that bring back specific memories?
Of course. I mean, I think of all the rehearsals we did and the joy of finally being together, working on a movie together and being there every day. And, you know, so we saw each other for a period of 3 or 4 months, 24 hours a day. And it wasn't bad. It was kind of beautiful.
If you don't mind me asking, this is a personal question, not a cinematic one. Was there a secret to your marriage?
I don't know if there was a secret. I don't know what you would call it. A secret, I think we... from the first minute I saw her, I fell in love, and it lasted until the day she died. And so, that was the secret. I mean, I just fell in love with her.
Well, that's a pretty good answer. So, thank you. Thank you very much, Mel. Congratulations.
Thank you, David. This has almost been fun.
Mel Brooks spoke with Fresh Air TV critic David Bianculli. Tonight, the PBS series American Masters presents a documentary about Brooks. David teaches at Rowan University in New Jersey.